Castile and that of Alvaron himself. But it was not a writ of patronage. I read through it carefully. By omission, it made it clear that neither was I in the mayor's service, nor were we bound to each other. Still, it granted me free travel and the right to perform under his name. It was an odd compromise of a document. I'd just finished dressing when there came another knock on the door. I sighed, half expecting more guards coming to roust me out of my rooms. But opening the door, I revealed another runner boy. He carried a silver tray bearing another letter. This one had the lacklace seal upon the top. Beside it lay a ring. I picked it up and turned it over in my hands, puzzled. It wasn't iron, as I'd expected, but pale wood. Maelowin's name was burned crudely into the side of it. I noticed the runner boy's wide eyes darting back and forth between the ring and myself. More importantly, I noticed the guards were not staring at it. Pointedly not staring. The sort of not staring you only engage in when something very interesting has come to your attention. I handed the boy my silver ring. "Take this to Braden," I said, "and don't dawdle." Braden was looking up at the guards as I opened the door.
"Keep up the good work, my boys," he said playfully,
tapping one of them on the chest with his walking stick. The silver wolf's head chimed lightly against the guard's breastplate, and Braden smiled like a jolly uncle.
"We all feel safer for your vigilance."
He closed the door behind himself and raised an eyebrow at me.
"Lord's mercy, boy, you're up the ladder by leaps and bounds. I knew you sat solid in the mayor's good grace, but to have him assign you two of his personal guard?"
He pressed his hand to his heart and sighed dramatically.
"Soon you will be too busy for the likes of poor old useless Braden."
I gave him a weak smile. "I think it's more complicated than that." I held up the wooden ring for him to see. "I need you to tell me what this means." Braden's jovial cheer evaporated more quickly than if I'd pulled out a bloody knife.
"Lord and lady," he said, "tell me you got that from some old-fashioned farmer."
I shook my head and handed it to him. He turned the ring over in his hands.
"Maelowin?"
he asked quietly. Handing it back, he sank into a nearby chair, his walking stick across his knees. His face had gone slightly gray.
"The mayor's new lady wife sent you this? As a summons?"
"It's about as far from a summons as anything can be," I said. "She sent a charming letter, too." I held it up with my other hand. Braden held out his hand.
"Can I see it?"
he asked, then drew his hand back quickly.
"I'm sorry. That's terribly rude of me to ask."
"You could do me no greater favor than reading it," I said, pressing it into his hands. "I am in desperate need of your opinion." Braden took the letter and began to read, his lips moving slightly. His expression grew paler as he made his way down the page. "The lady has a gift for well-turned phrase," I said.
"That cannot be denied," he said. "She might as well have written this in blood."
"I think she would have liked to," I said, "but she would have to kill herself to fill the second page." I held it out to him. Braden took it and continued to read, his face growing even paler.
"God's all around us," he said. "Is excrescence even a word?" he asked.
"It is," I said. Braden finished the second page, then went back to the beginning and slowly read it through a second time. Finally, he looked up at me.
"If there were a woman," he said, "who loved me with one-tenth the passion this lady feels for you, I would count myself the luckiest of men."
"What does this mean?" I asked, holding up the ring. I could smell smoke on it. She must have burned her name into it just this morning.
"From a farmer?" he shrugged. "Many things, depending on the wood. But here, from one of the nobility..."
He shook his head, obviously at a loss for words. "I thought there were only three types of courtly rings," I said.
"Only three a person would use," he said. "Only three that are sent and displayed. It used to be you sent wooden rings to summon servants, those too low for iron.
But that was a long while back. Eventually it became a terrible snub to send someone in the court a wooden ring. A snub I can live with, I said, relieved. I've been snubbed by better folk than her.
That was 100 years ago, Brayden said. Things have changed. The problem was, once the wooden rings were seen as a snub, some servants would be offended by them. You don't want to offend the master of your stables, so you don't send him a wooden ring. But if he doesn't get a wooden ring, then your tailor might be offended by one.
I nodded my understanding. And so on. Eventually everyone was offended by a wooden ring. Brayden nodded.
A wise man is careful to stay on the good side of his servants, he said. Even the boy that brings your dinner can carry a grudge, and there are 1,000 invisible revenges available to the lowest of them. Wooden rings aren't used at all anymore. They probably would have fallen out of memory entirely if they weren't used as a plot device in a handful of plays.
I looked at the ring. So I'm lower than the boy who collects the slops. Brayden cleared his throat self-consciously.
More than that, actually,
he pointed.
That means to her, you aren't even a person. You aren't worth recognizing as a human being.
Ah, I said. I see. I slid the wooden ring onto my finger and made a fist. It was quite a good fit, actually.
It's not the sort of ring you wear, Brayden said uncomfortably. It's quite the other sort of ring, actually.
He gave me a curious look.
I don't suppose you still have Alvaron's ring.
He asked for it back, actually. I picked the mayor's letter off the table and handed it to Brayden as well.
At your earliest convenience, Brayden quoted with a dry chuckle. That says quite a bit more than it seems.
He set the letter down.
Still, it's probably better this way. If he left you with his favor, you'd be a battleground for them, a peppercorn between her mortar and his pestle. They would crush you with their bickering.
His eyes flickered back to the wooden ring on my hand.
I don't suppose she gave it to you personally,
he asked hopefully. She sent it with a runner. I let out a low sigh.
The guards saw it too.
There was a knock on the door. I answered it, and a runner boy handed me a letter. I closed the door and looked at the seal.
Lord Prevec, I said.
Brayden shook his head.
I swear that man spends every waking moment with his ear against a keyhole or his tongue up someone's ass.
Chuckling, I cracked the letter open and scanned it quickly. He's asking for his ring back, I said. It's smudged, too. He didn't even wait for the ink to dry. Brayden nodded.
Word is undoubtedly spreading. It wouldn't be so bad if she wasn't sitting strong at Alvaron's right hand. But she is, and she's made her opinion clear. Anyone who treats you better than a dog will doubtless share the scorn she feels for you.
He fluttered her letter.
And scorn such as this, there's plenty to go around without worry of it spreading thin.
Brayden gestured to the bowl of rings and gave a dry, mirthless chuckle.
Just when you were getting some silver, too.
I walked over to the bowl, dug out his ring, and held it out to him. You should take this back, I said. Brayden's expression looked pained, but he made no move to take the ring. I'm going to be leaving soon, I said, and I'd hate for you to be tarnished by your contact with me. There's no way I can thank you for the help you've given me. The least I can do is help minimize the damage to your reputation. Brayden hesitated, then closed his eyes and sighed. He took the ring with a defeated shrug. Oh, I said, suddenly remembering something else. I went to the stack of slanderous stories and pulled out the pages that described his pagan frolics. You might find this amusing, I said as I handed it to him. Now you should probably go. Simply being here can't be good for you. Brayden sighed and nodded.
I'm sorry it didn't work out better for you, my boy. If you're ever back in these parts, don't hesitate to call on me. These things do blow over eventually.
His eyes kept drifting back to the wooden ring on my finger.
You really shouldn't keep wearing that.
After he was gone, I fished Stapes's gold ring out of the bowl and Alvaron's iron one as well. Then I stepped out into the hallway. I'm going to pay a call on Stapes, I said politely to the guards. Would the two of you care to accompany me? The taller one glanced at the ring on my finger, then looked at his companion before murmuring an agreement. I turned on my heel and set off, my escort keeping pace behind me. Stapes ushered me inside his sitting room and closed the door behind me. His rooms were even finer than my own and considerably more lived in. I also saw a large bowl of rings on a nearby table. All of them were gold. The only iron ring in sight was Alvaron's, and that was on his finger. He might look like a grocer, but Stapes had a sharp set of eyes. He spotted the ring on my finger straight away.
"She did it, then," he said, shaking his head. "You really shouldn't wear it."
"I'm not ashamed of what I am," I said. "If this is the ring of an Edema Rue, I'll wear it." Stapes sighed.
"It's more complicated than that."
"I know," I said. "I didn't come here to make your life difficult." "Could you return this to the mayor for me?" I handed him Alvaron's ring. Stapes put it in his pocket. "I also wanted to return these." I handed him the two rings he had given me. One bright gold, one white bone. "I don't want to make trouble between you and your master's new wife." Stapes nodded, holding up the gold ring.
"It would make trouble if you kept it," he said. "I am in the mayor's service. As such, I need to be mindful of the games of the court."
Then he reached out and took my hand, pressing the bone ring back into it.
"But this lies outside my duty to the mayor. It is a debt between two men. The games of the court have no sway over such things."
Stapes met my eye.
"And I insist you keep it."
I ate a late supper alone in my rooms. The guards were still waiting patiently outside as I read the mayor's letter for the fifth time. Each time I hoped to find some clement sentiment hidden in his phrasing, but it simply wasn't there. On the table sat the various papers the mayor had sent. I emptied my purse beside them. I had 2 gold royals, 4 silver nobles, 8.5 pennies, and, inexplicably, a single Modegan Stralum, though I couldn't for the life of me remember where I'd come by it. Altogether, they equaled slightly less than 8 talents. I stacked them next to Alvaron's papers. 8 talents, a pardon, a player's writ, and my tuition paid at the university. It was not an inconsiderable reward. Still, I couldn't help but feel rather shorted. I had saved Alvaron from a poisoning, uncovered a traitor in his court, won him a wife, and rid his roads of more dangerous folk than I cared to count. Despite all that, I was still left without a patron. Worse, his letter had made no mention of the Emir, no mention of the support he had promised to lend me in my search for them. But there was nothing to be gained by making a fuss, and much that I could lose. I refilled my purse and tucked Alvaron's letters into the secret compartment in my loot case. I also nicked 3 books I'd brought from Cauticus's library, since no one knew I had them, and tipped the bowl full of rings into a small sack. The wardrobe held 2 dozen finely tailored outfits. They were worth a heavy penny, but weren't very portable. I took 2 of the nicer outfits and left the rest hanging. Lastly, I belted on Susura and worked my shade into a long cape. Those 2 items reassured me that my time in Ventus had not been entirely wasted, though I'd earned them on my own, not through any help of Alvaron's. I locked the door, snuffed the lamps, and climbed out a window into the garden. Then I used a piece of bent wire to lock the window and close the shutters behind me. Petty mischief? Perhaps, but I'd be damned if I'd be escorted from the estates by the mayor's guard. Besides, the thought of them puzzling over my escape made me chuckle, and laughter is good for the digestion. I made my way out of the estates without anyone seeing me. My shade was well suited to sneaking about in the dark. After an hour of searching, I found a greasy bookbinder in Severin Low. He was an unsavory fellow with the morals of a feral dog, but he was interested in the stack of slanderous stories the nobility had been sending to my rooms. He offered me 4 reels for the lot of them, plus the promise of 10 pennies for every volume of the book he sold after they were printed. I bargained him up to 6 reels and 6 pennies per copy, and we shook hands. I left his shop, burned the contract, and washed my hands twice. I did keep the money, however. After that, I sold both suits of fine clothing and all of Caudicus's books, except for one. With the money I'd accumulated, I spent the next several hours on the docks and found a ship leaving the next day for Junpei. As night settled under the city, I wandered the high parts of Severn, hoping I might run into Denna. I didn't, of course. I could tell she was long gone. A city feels different when Denna is somewhere inside it, and Severn felt as hollow as an empty egg. At the end of several hours of fruitless searching, I stopped by a dockside brothel and spent some time drinking in the taproom. It was a slow night, and the ladies were bored. So I bought drinks for everyone, and we talked. I told a few stories, and they listened. I played a few songs, and they applauded. Then I asked a favor, and they laughed and laughed and laughed. So I poured the sack full of rings into a bowl and left them on the bar. Soon, the ladies were trying them on and arguing over who would get the silver ones. I bought another round of drinks and left. My mood somewhat improved. I wandered aimlessly after that, eventually finding a small public garden near the lip of the Sheer looking out over Severn Low. The lamps below were burning orange, while here or there a gaslight or sympathy lamp flickered greenish-blue and crimson. It was as breathtaking as the first time I had seen it. I had been watching for some time before I realized I wasn't alone. An older man leaned against a tree several feet away, looking down at the lights much as I had been. A faint and not unpleasant aroma of beer wafted from him.
"She's a pretty thing, isn't she?"
he said, his accent marking him as a dock worker. I agreed. We watched the twinkling fires silently for a time. I unscrewed the wooden ring from my finger and considered throwing it off the cliff. Now that someone was watching, I couldn't help but feel the gesture was somewhat childish.
"They say a nobleman can piss on half a Severin from up here,"
the dockman said conversationally. I tucked the ring into a pocket of my shade. A memento, then. "Those are the lazy ones," I replied. "The ones I've met can piss a lot further than that." Chapter 141. A Journey to Return. Fate favored me on the way back to the university. We had a good wind, and everything was delightfully uneventful. The sailors had heard of my encounter with Falurian, so I enjoyed a modest fame for the duration of the trip. I played them the song I had written about it, and told them the story about half as often as they asked me to. I also told them about my trip to the Adem. They didn't believe a piece of it at first, but then I showed them the sword and threw their best wrestler 3 times. They showed me a different sort of respect after that, and a rougher, more honest sort of friendship. I learned a goodly bit from them on my journey home. They told me sea stories and the names of stars. They talked about wind, water, and women. Sorry, women. They tried to teach me sailor's knots, but I didn't have a knack for it, though I proved to be a dab hand at untying them. Altogether, it was very pleasant. The friendship of the sailors, the song of the wind in the rigging, the smell of sweat and salt and tar. Over the long days, these things slowly eased the bitterness I felt toward my ill treatment at the hands of Mayor Alvaron and his loving lady wife. Chapter 142. Home. Eventually, we docked in Tarbian, where the sailors helped me find a cheap berth on a billow boat heading upstream toward Annalyn. I got off 2 days later in Imre and walked to the university just as the first blue light of dawn was coloring the sky. I've never in my life had anything like a home. As a young child, I grew up on the road, endlessly traveling with my troop. Home wasn't a place. It was people and wagons. Later in Tarbian, I had had a secret place where 3 roofs came together and gave me shelter from the rain. I slept there and hid a few precious things, but it wasn't anything like a home. Because of this, I'd never in my life enjoyed the feeling of coming home after a journey. I felt it for the first time that day as I crossed the Omethi, the stones of the bridge familiar underneath my feet. As I came to the tallest part of its broad arch, I could see the gray shape of the archives rising out of the trees ahead of me. The streets of the university were comforting under my feet. I'd been gone for 3/4 of a year. In some ways, it seemed much longer, but at the same time, everything here felt so familiar that it felt like hardly any time at all had passed. It was still early when I got to Anchors, and the front door was locked. I briefly considered climbing up to my window, then thought better of it, given that I was carrying my loot case and travel sack, and wearing Sasura as well. Instead, I made my way to the Muse and knocked on Simmons' door. It was early, and I knew I'd be waking him, but I was hungry for a familiar face. After waiting a short minute and hearing nothing, I knocked again, louder, and practiced my best jaunty smile. Sim opened the door, his hair in disarray, his eyes red from too little sleep. He looked blearily out at me. For the space of a breath, his expression was blank. Then he hurled himself at me with a crushing hug. "Blackened body of God!" he said, using stronger language than I'd ever heard from him before. "Quoth! You're alive!" Sim had a bit of a cry, then shouted at me for a while, and then we laughed and sorted matters out. It seems Threp had been keeping closer tabs on my travels than I'd thought. Consequently, when my ship had gone missing, he'd assumed the worst. A letter would have cleared things up, but I'd never thought to send one. The thought of writing home was utterly alien to me. "The ship was reported as all hands lost," Sim said. "Word spread around the Aeolian, and guess who heard the news?" "Stanchion?" I asked, knowing he was a terrible gossip. Sim shook his head grimly. "Ambrose." "Oh, lovely," I observed dryly. "It would have been bad coming from anyone," Sim said. "But it was worst from him. I was half convinced he'd somehow arranged to sink your ship." He gave a sickly smile. "He waited until right before admissions before he broke the news to me. Needless to say, I pissed all over myself during my exam and spent another term as an Allier." "Spent?" I said. "You made R'hllar?" He grinned. "Just yesterday. I was sleeping off the celebration when you woke me up this morning." "How's Will?" I asked. "Did he take the news hard?" "Even keeled as always," Sim said. "But for all that, yeah, pretty hard." He grimaced. "Ambrose has been making his life difficult in the archives, too. Will got fed up with it and went home for a term. He should be back today." "How's everyone else?" I asked. A thought seemed to strike Sim all of a sudden. He stood up. "Oh, God, fella!" Then he sat down hard, as if his legs had been cut from underneath him. "Oh, God, fella!" he said in a completely different tone. "What?" I asked. "Did something happen to her?" "She didn't take the news well either." He gave me a shaky smile. "It turns out she had quite a thing for you." "Fella?" I said stupidly. "Don't you remember? Will and I thought she liked you." It seemed like years ago. "I remember." Sim seemed uncomfortable. "Well, you see, while you were gone, Will and I started spending a lot of time with her, and..." He made an inarticulate gesture. His expression was stuck between sheepish and grinning. Realization struck. "You and Fella? Sim, that's great!" I felt a grin spread across my face, then saw his expression. "Oh." My grin fell away. "Sim, I wouldn't get in the way of that." "I know you wouldn't." He smiled a sickly smile. "I trust you." I rubbed my eyes. "This is a hell of a homecoming. I haven't even been through admissions yet." "Today's the last day," Sim pointed out. "I know," I said, getting to my feet. "I have an errand to run first." I left my baggage in Simmons' room and paid a visit to the bursar in the basement of Hollows. Ream was a balding, pinch-faced man who had disliked me ever since the masters had assigned me a negative tuition in my first term. He wasn't in the habit of giving money out, and the entire experience had rubbed him the wrong way. I showed him my open letter of credit to Alvaron's coffers. As I've said, it was an impressive document, signed by the mayor's own hand, wax seals, fine vellum, excellent penmanship. I drew the bursar's attention to the fact that the mayor's letter would allow the university to draw any amount needed to cover my tuition. Any amount. The bursar read it over and agreed that that seemed to be the case. "It's too bad my tuition was always so low," I mused aloud. "Never more than 10 talents. It was a bit of a missed opportunity for the university. The mayor was richer than the king of Vint, after all. And he would pay any tuition." Ream was a savvy man, and he understood what I was hinting at immediately. There followed a brief bout of negotiation, after which we shook hands, and I saw him smile for the first time. I grabbed a bite of lunch, then waited in line with the rest of the students who didn't have admissions tiles. Most of them were new students, but a few were applying for readmission like myself. It was a long line, and everyone was visibly nervous to some degree. I whistled to pass the time, and bought a meat pie and a mug of hot cider from a man with a cart. I caused a bit of a stir when I stepped into the circle of light in front of the master's table. They had heard the news and were surprised to see me alive, most of them pleasantly so. Kilvin demanded I report to the workshop soon, while Mandrag, Dahl, and Arwill argued over which courses of study I would pursue. Elodin merely waved at me, the only one apparently unimpressed by my miraculous return from the dead. After a minute of congenial chaos, the Chancellor got things back under control and started my interview. I answered Dahl's questions easily enough, and Kilvin's, but I fumbled my cipher with Brandor, then had to admit I simply didn't know the answer to Mandrag's question about sublimation. Elodin shrugged away his opportunity to question me, yawning hugely. Lauren asked a surprisingly easy question about the Mender heresies, and I managed a quick and clever answer for him. I had to think for a long moment before answering Arwill's question about Lucilium. That left only Hem, who had been scowling furiously since I'd first stepped up to the master's table. My lackluster performance and slow answers had brought a smug curve to his lips by this point. His eyes gleamed whenever I gave a wrong answer. "Well, well," he said, shuffling through the sheaf of papers in front of him. "I didn't think we'd have to deal with your type of trouble again." He gave me an insincere smile. "I'd heard you were dead."
"I heard you wear a red lace corset," I said matter-of-factly, "but I don't believe every bit of nonsense that gets rumored about."
Some shouting followed, and I was quickly brought up on charges of improper address of a master. I was sentenced to compose a letter of apology and find a single silver talent. Money well spent. It was bad behavior, though, and poorly timed, especially after my otherwise lackluster performance. As a result, I was assigned a tuition of 24 talents. Needless to say, I was terribly embarrassed. Afterward, I returned to the bursar's office. I officially presented Alvaron's letter of credit to Ream and unofficially collected my agreed-upon cut, half of everything over 10 talents. I put the 7 talents in my purse and wondered idly if anyone had ever been paid so well for insolence and ignorance. I headed to Anchor's, where I was pleased to discover no one had informed the owner of my death. The key to my room was somewhere at the bottom of the Sentha Sea, but Anchor had a spare. I went upstairs and felt myself relax at the familiar sight of the sloping ceiling and narrow bed. Everything was covered in a thin layer of dust. You might think my tiny room with its sloped ceiling and narrow bed would feel cramped after my grand suite in Alvaron's estate, but nothing could be further from the truth. I busied myself unpacking my travel sack and getting cobwebs out of corners. After an hour, I'd managed to pick the lock on the trunk at the foot of my bed and unpack the things I'd stored away. I rediscovered my half-dismantled harmony clock and tinkered with it idly, trying to remember whether I'd been in the middle of taking it apart or putting it back together. Then, since I had no other pressing engagements, I made my way back across the river. I stopped at the Aeolian, where Diok greeted me with an enthusiastic bear hug that lifted me from the ground. After so long on the road, so much time spent among strangers and enemies, I'd forgotten what it was like to be surrounded by the warmth of friendly faces. Diok, Stanchion, and I shared drinks and traded stories until it started to get dark outside, and I left them to tend to their business. I prowled the city for a while, going to a few familiar boarding houses and taverns. Two or three public gardens, a bench beneath a tree in a courtyard. Diok told me he hadn't so much as glimpsed Denna's shadow in a year, but even looking for her and not finding her was comforting in a way. In some ways, that seemed to be the heart of our relationship. Later that night, I climbed onto Mains and made my way through the familiar maze of chimneys and mismatched slate and clay and tin. I came around a corner and saw Ari sitting on a chimney, her long, fine hair floating around her head as if she were underwater. She was staring up at the moon and swinging her bare feet. I cleared my throat softly, and Ari turned to look. She hopped off the chimney and came scampering across the roof, pulling up a few steps short of me. Her grin was brighter than the moon. "There is a whole family of hedgehogs living in Cricklet," she said excitedly. Ari took two more steps and grabbed my hand with both of hers. "There are babies tiny as acorns." She tugged at me gently. "Will you come see?" I nodded, and Ari led me across the roof to the apple tree we could use to climb down into the courtyard. When we finally got there, she looked at the tree, then down to where she still held my long, tan hand with both of her tiny white ones. Her grip wasn't tight, but it was firm, and she didn't give any sign of letting go. "I missed you," she said softly without looking up. "Don't go away again." "I don't ever plan on leaving," I said gently. "I have too much to do here." Ari tilted her head sideways to peek up at me through the cloud of her hair.
"Like visit me?"
"Like visit you," I agreed. Chapter 143, Bloodless. There was one final surprise waiting for me on my return to the university. I'd been back for a handful of days before I returned to my work in the fishery. While I was no longer in desperate need of money, I missed the work. There is something deeply satisfying in shaping something with your hands. Proper artificing is like a song made solid. It is an act of creation. So I went to Stocks, thinking to start with something simple, as I was out of practice. As I approached the window, I saw a familiar face.
"Hello, Basil," I said. "What did you do to get stuck here this time?"
He looked down.
"Improper handling of reagents," he muttered.
I laughed.
"That's not so bad. You'll be out in a span or so."
"Yeah."
He looked up and gave a shame-faced grin.
"I heard you were back. You come for your credit?"
I stopped halfway through my mental list of everything I'd need to make a heat funnel.
"I beg your pardon?"
Basil cocked his head to the side.
"Your credit," he repeated.
"For the bloodless."
He looked at me for a moment, then realization dawned on his face.
"That's right. You wouldn't know."
He stepped away from the window for a moment and returned with something that looked like an eight-sided lamp made entirely of iron. It was different than the arrow catch I'd made. The one I'd constructed was built from scratch and rather rough around the edges. This one was smooth and sleek. All the pieces fit together snugly, and it was covered in a thin layer of clear alchemical enamel that would protect it from rain and rust. Clever. I should have included that in my original design. While part of me was flattered that someone had liked my design enough to copy it, a larger part of me was irritated to see an arrow catch so much more polished than my original. I noticed a telltale uniformity in the pieces.
"Someone made a set of moldings?" I asked.
Basil nodded.
"Oh, yes. Ages ago. Two sets."
He smiled.
"I've got to say, it's clever stuff. Took me a long while to get my head around how the inertial trigger worked, but now that I've got it," he tapped his forehead, "I've made two myself. Good money for the time they take. Beats the hell out of deck lamps."
That wrung a smile out of me.
Anything is better than deck lamps, I agreed, picking it up.
Is this one of yours?
He shook his head. Mine sold a month back. They don't sit long. Clever of you to price them so low. I turned it over in my hands and saw a word grooved into the metal. The blocky letters went deep into the iron, so I knew they were part of the mold. They read, Bloodless. I looked up at Basil. He smiled.
You took off without giving it a proper name, he said. Then Kilvin formalized the schema and added it to the records. We needed to call it something before we started to sell it.
His smile faded a bit.
But that was around the same time word came back you'd been lost at sea. So Kilvin brought in Master Elodin
to give it a proper name, I said, still turning it in my hands.
Of course.
Kilvin grumbled a bit, Basil said. Called it dramatic nonsense, but it stuck.
He shrugged and ducked down and rummaged a bit before bringing up a book. Anyway, you want your credit?
He started flipping pages.
You've got to have a chunk of it built up by now. Lot of folk have been making them.
He found the page he wanted and ran his finger along the ledger line.
There we are. Sold 28 so far.
Basil, I said, I really don't understand what you're talking about.
Kilvin already paid me for the first one I made.
Basil furrowed his brow.
Your commission, he said matter-of-factly. Then, seeing my blank look, he continued. Every time stock sells something, the fishery gets a 30% commission, and whoever owns the schema gets 10%.
I thought stocks kept the whole 40, I said, shocked.
He lifted one shoulder in a shrug. Most times it does. Stocks owns most of the old schemas. Most things have already been invented. But for something new...
Manette never mentioned that, I said.
Basil gave an apologetic grimace. Old Manette is a workhorse, he said politely. But he's not the most innovative fellow around. He's been here, what, 30 years? I don't think he has a single schema to his name.
He flipped through the book a bit, scanning the pages.
Most serious artificers have at least one just as a point of pride, even if it's something fairly useless.
Numbers spun in my head. So 10% of 8 talents each, I murmured, then looked up.
I've got 22 talents waiting for me?
Basil nodded, looking at the entry in the book.
22 and 4, he said, bringing out a pencil and a piece of paper. You want all of it?
I grinned.
When I set out for Imray, my purse was so heavy I feared I might develop a limp. I stopped by Anchors and picked up my travel sack, resting it on my opposite shoulder to balance things out. I wandered through town, idly passing by all the places Denna and I had frequented in the past. I wondered where in the world she might be. After my ritual search was complete, I made my way to a back alley that smelled of rancid fat and climbed a set of narrow stairs. I knocked briskly on Davy's door, waited for a long minute, then knocked again, louder. There was the sound of a bolt being thrown and a lock turning. The door cracked open and a single pale blue eye peered out at me. I grinned. The door swung open slowly. Davy stood in the doorway, staring blankly at me, her arms at her sides. I raised an eyebrow at her.
What?
I said. No witty banter?
I don't do business on the landing, she said automatically.
Her voice was absolutely without inflection.
You'll have to come inside.
I waited, but she didn't step out of the doorway. I could smell cinnamon and honey wafting out from the room behind her.
Davy? I asked.
Are you okay?
You're a...
She trailed off, still staring at me. Her voice was flat and emotionless.
You're supposed to be dead.
In this and many other things, I aim to disappoint, I said.
I was sure he'd done it, Davy continued.
His father's barony is called the Pirate Isles. I was sure he'd done it because we'd set fire to his rooms. I was the one that actually set the fire, but he couldn't know that. You were the only one he saw. You and that Sealish fellow.
Davy looked up at me, blinking in the light. The pixie-faced Gaelit had always been fair-skinned,
but this was the first time I'd ever seen her look pale.
"You're taller," she said.
"I'd almost forgotten how tall you are."
"I almost forgot how pretty you are," I said, but I couldn't quite manage it.
Davy continued to stand in the doorway, pale and staring. Concerned, I stepped forward and laid my hand lightly on her arm. She didn't pull away as I half expected. She simply looked down at my hand.
"I'm waiting for a quip here," I teased gently. "You're usually quicker than this."
"I don't think I can match wits with you right now," she said.
"I never suspected you could match wits with me," I said. "But I do like a little banter now and then."
Davy gave a ghost of a smile, a little color coming back to her cheeks.
"You're a horse's ass," she said.
"That's more like it," I said encouragingly as I drew her out of the doorway into the bright autumn afternoon. "I knew you had it in you." The two of us walked to a nearby inn, and with the help of a short beer and long lunch, Davy recovered from the shock of seeing me alive. Soon, she was her usual sharp-tongued self again, and we bantered back and forth over mugs of spiced cider. Afterward, we strolled back to her rooms behind the butcher shop, where Davy discovered she'd forgotten to lock her door.
"Merciful Tailu," she said once we were inside, looking around frantically. "That's a first."
Looking around, I saw that little had changed in her room since I'd last seen them, though her second set of bookshelves was almost half full. I looked over the titles as Davy searched the other rooms to make sure nothing was missing.
"Anything you'd like to borrow?" she asked as she came back into the room.
"Actually," I said, "I have something for you." I set my travel sack on her desk and rooted around until I found a flat rectangular package wrapped in oilskin and tied with twine. I moved my travel sack onto the floor and put the package on the desk, nudging it toward her. Davy approached the desk wearing a dubious expression, then sat down and unwrapped the parcel. Inside was the copy of Selim Tincher I'd stolen from Caudicus's library. Not a particularly rare book, but a useful resource for an alchemist exiled from the archives. Not that I knew anything about alchemy, of course. Davy looked down at it.
"And what's this for?" she asked.
I laughed.
"It's a present."
She eyed me narrowly.
"If you think this will get you an extension on your loan..."
I shook my head. "I just thought you'd like it," I said. "As for the loan..." I brought out my purse and counted 9 thick talents onto her desk.
"Well then," Davy said, mildly surprised.
"It looks like someone had a profitable trip." She looked up at me.
"Are you sure you don't want to wait until after you've paid tuition?"
"Already taken care of," I said. Davy made no move to take the money.
"I wouldn't want to leave you penniless at the start of the new term," she said.
I hefted my purse in one hand. It clinked with a delightful fullness that was almost musical. Davy brought out a key and unlocked a drawer at the bottom of her desk. One by one, she brought out my copy of Rhetoric and Logic, my talent pipes, my sympathy lamp, and Denna's ring. She piled them neatly on her desk, but still didn't reach for the coins.
"You still have 2 months before your year and a day is up," she said. "Are you sure you wouldn't prefer to wait?"
Puzzled, I looked down at the money on the table, then around at Davy's rooms. Realization came to me like a flower unfurling in my head.
"This isn't about the money at all, is it?"
I said, amazed it had taken me this long to figure it out. Davy cocked her head to the side. I gestured at the bookshelves, the large velvet-curtained bed, at Davy herself. I'd never noticed before, but while her clothes weren't fancy, the cut and cloth were fine as any noble's.
"This doesn't have anything to do with money," I repeated.
I looked at her books. Her collection had to be worth 500 talents if it was worth a penny.
"You use the money as bait. You lend it out to desperate folks who might be useful to you, then hope they can't pay you back. Your real business is favors."
Davy chuckled a bit.
"Money is nice," she said, her eyes glittering. "But the world is full of things that people would never sell.
favors and obligation are worth far, far more. I looked down at the 9 talents gleaming on her desk. You don't have a minimum loan amount, do you? I asked, already knowing the answer. You just told me that so I'd be forced to borrow more. You were hoping I'd dig myself a hole too deep and not be able to pay you back. Davy smiled brightly. Welcome to the game, she said as she began to pick up the coins. Thanks for playing. Chapter 144 Sword and Shade. With my purse full to bursting and Alvaron's letter of credit assuring my tuition, my winter term was carefree as a walk in the garden. It was strange not having to live like a miser. I had clothes that fit me and could afford to have them laundered. I could have coffee or chocolate whenever I wanted. I no longer needed to toil endlessly in the fishery and could spend time tinkering simply to satisfy my curiosity or pursue projects simply for the joy of it. After almost a year away, it took me a while to settle back into the university. It felt odd not wearing a sword after all this time, but such things were frowned on here, and I knew it would cause more trouble than it was worth. At first, I left Sasura in my rooms, but I knew better than anyone how easy it would be to break in and steal it. The drop bar would only keep away a very genteel thief. A more pragmatic one could simply break my window and be gone in less than a minute. Since the sword was quite literally irreplaceable, and I'd made promises to keep it safe, it wasn't long before I moved it to a hiding place in the underthing. My shade was easier to keep at hand, as I was able to change its shape with a little work. These days, it only rarely billowed on its own. More commonly, it refused to move as much as the gusting wind seemed to demand. You'd think people would notice such things, but they didn't. Even Willem and Simon, who teased me about my fondness for it, never marked my cloak as anything more than an exceptionally versatile piece of clothing. In fact, Elodin was the only one to notice anything out of the ordinary about it. "What's this?" he exclaimed when we crossed paths in a small courtyard outside Mainz. "How did you come to be in Shaden?" "I beg your pardon?" I asked. "Your cloak, boy! Your turning cape! How in God's sweet grace did you tumble onto a shade?" He mistook my surprise for ignorance. "Don't you know what you're wearing?" "I know what it is," I said. "I'm just surprised that you do." He gave me an insulted look. "I wouldn't be much of a namer if I couldn't spot a fairy cloak 12 feet away." He took a corner of it between his fingers. "Oh, that's just lovely. Here's a piece of old magic man rarely lays a finger on." "It's new magic, actually," I said. "What do you mean?" he asked. When it became obvious my explanation involved a long story, Elodin led us into a small, cozy pub I'd never seen before. I hesitate to call it a pub at all, actually. It wasn't full of chattering students and the smell of beer. It was dim and quiet, with a low ceiling and scattered clusters of deep, comfortable chairs. It smelled of leather and old wine. We sat near a warm radiator and sipped mulled cider while I told him the whole story of my unintentional trip into the Fae. It was a wonderful relief. I hadn't been able to tell anyone yet for fear of being laughed out of the university. Elodin proved to be a surprisingly attentive audience and was especially interested in the fight Valorian and I had had when she had tried to bend me to her will. After I'd finished the story, he peppered me with questions. Could I remember what I'd said to call the wind? How had it felt? The strange wakefulness I described, was it more like being drunk, or more like going into shock? I answered as best I could, and eventually he leaned back in his chair, nodding to himself. "It's a good sign when a student goes chasing the wind and catches it," he said approvingly. "That's twice you've called it now. It can only get easier." "Three times, actually," I said. "I found it again when I was off in Ademre." He laughed. "You chased it to the edge of the map," he said, making a broad motion with his splayed left hand. Stunned, I realized it was Adem hand talk for amazed respect. "How did it feel? Do you think you could find its name again if you had need of it?" I concentrated, trying to nudge my mind into spinning leaf. It had been a month and 1,000 miles since I'd tried, and it was hard to tip my mind into that strange, tumbling emptiness. Eventually, I managed it. I looked around the small room, hoping to see the name of the wind like a familiar friend, but there was nothing there except dust motes swirling in a beam of sunlight that slanted through a window.
"Well?" Elodin asked. "Could you call it if you needed to?"
I hesitated. "Maybe." Elodin nodded as if he understood.
"But probably not if someone were to ask you to."
I nodded, more than a little disappointed.
"Don't be discouraged. It will give us something to work toward."
He grinned happily and clapped me on the back.
"But I think there's more to your story than you realize. You called more than the wind. From what you've said, I believe you called Felurian's name itself."
I thought back. My memories of my time in the Fae were oddly patchy, none more than my confrontation with Felurian, which had an odd, almost dreamlike quality to it. When I tried to remember it in detail, it almost seemed as if it had happened to another person.
"I suppose it's possible."
"It's more than possible," he assured me.
"I doubt a creature as old and powerful as Felurian could be subdued with nothing more than wind. Not to belittle your accomplishment," he hurried to add. "Calling the wind is more than one student in 1,000 ever manages, but calling the name of a living thing, let alone one of the Fae..."
He raised his eyebrows at me.
"That's a horse of a different color."
"Why would a person's name be so much different?" I asked, then answered my own question.
"The complexity."
"Exactly," he said. My understanding seemed to excite him.
"To name a thing, you must understand it entire. A stone or a piece of wind is difficult enough. A person?"
He trailed off significantly.
"I couldn't claim to understand Felurian," I said. "Some part of you did," he insisted. "Your sleeping mind. A rare thing indeed. If you'd known how difficult it was, you never would have stood a chance of doing it."
Since poverty no longer forced me to work endless hours in the fishery, I was free to study more broadly than ever before. I continued my usual classes in sympathy, medicine, and artificing, then added chemistry, herbology, and comparative female anatomy. My curiosity had been pricked by my encounter with the lockless box, and I attempted to learn something about Yillish story knots. But I quickly discovered most books on Yill were historical, not linguistic, and gave no information as to how I might actually read a knot. So I scoured the dead ledgers and discovered a single shelf of disused books concerning Yill in one of the unpleasant, low-ceilinged sections of the lower basements. Then, while looking for a place to sit and read, I discovered a small room tucked behind a piece of jutting shelving. It wasn't a reading hole as I suspected. Inside were hundreds of large wooden spools wound about with knotted string. They weren't books, precisely, but they were the Yillish equivalent. A thin layer of dust covered everything, and I doubted anyone had been in the room for decades. I have a vast weakness for secret things, but I quickly found that reading the knots was impossible without first understanding Yillish. There were no classes on the subject, and asking around revealed none of Master Linguist Giller's knew more than a scattering of words. I wasn't terribly surprised, considering Yill had been nearly ground to dust under the iron boots of the Aeturan Empire. The piece that remained today was populated mostly by sheep, and if you stood in the middle of the country, you could throw a stone across the border. Still, it was a disappointing end to my search. Then, several days later, Master Linguist summoned me to his office. He'd heard that I'd been making inquiries, and he happened to speak Yillish rather well. He offered to tutor me personally, and I gladly took him up on his offer. Since I'd come to the university, I'd only seen Master Linguist during admissions interviews and when I was brought up on the horns for disciplinary reasons. Acting as chancellor, he was rather grim and formal, but when he wasn't sitting in the chancellor's chair, Master Herma was a surprisingly deft and gentle teacher. He was witty with a surprisingly irreverent sense of humor. The first time he told me a dirty joke, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Elodin wasn't teaching a class this term, but I began to study naming privately under his direction. It went more smoothly now that I understood there was a method to his madness. Count Threp was overjoyed to find me alive and threw a resurrection party where I was proudly displayed to the local nobility. I had a suit of clothes tailored specifically for the event, and in a fit of nostalgia, I chose to have them done in the colors my old troop had worn, the green and gray of Lord Greyfellow's men. After the party, over a bottle of wine in his sitting room, I told Threp of my adventures. I left off the story of Falurian, as I knew he wouldn't believe it, and I couldn't tell him half of what I'd done in the mayor's service. Consequently, Threp thought Alvaron had been quite generous in rewarding me. I didn't argue the point. Chapter 145. Stories. Ambrose had been blessedly absent during the winter term, but when spring arrived, he came back to roost like some sort of hateful migratory bird. By no coincidence, the day after he returned, I skipped all my classes and spent the entire day making myself a new Graham. As soon as the snow melted and the ground grew firm again, I resumed my practice of the Catan. Remembering how odd it had looked when I'd first seen it, I did this in the privacy of the forest north of the university. With spring term came a new round of admissions. I showed up for my interview with a profound hangover and fumbled a few questions. My tuition was set at 18 talents and 5, earning me 4 talents and change from the bursar. Sales of the Bloodless had slackened over the winter, as there were fewer merchants visiting the university. But once snows melted and roads grew dry, the handful that had accumulated in the stock sold quickly, bringing me another 6 talents. I was unused to having so much money at my disposal, and I'll admit I went a little mad with it. I owned 6 suits of clothes that fit me and had all the paper I could use. I bought fine, dark ink from Arua and purchased my own set of engraving tools. I had 2 pairs of shoes. 2! I found an ancient, ragged Yilish dictum buried in a bookstore in Imre. Full of drawings of knots, the bookstore owner thought it was a sailor's journal, and I bought it for a mere talent and a half. Not long after, I bought a copy of the Herborica, then added a copy of Termagus Technica I could use as a reference while designing schema in the privacy of my own room. I bought dinner for my friends. Ari had new dresses and bright ribbons for her hair. All this and still money in my purse. How odd. How wonderful. Toward the middle of the term, I began to hear familiar stories. Stories about a certain red-haired adventurer who had spent the night with Falurian. Stories of a dashing young arcanist with all the powers of Tabberlin the Great. It had taken months, but my exploits in Vintus had finally passed their way from mouth to ear all the long miles back to the university. It may be true that when I finally became aware of these stories, I lengthened my shade a bit and wore it more often than before. It might also be the case that I spent a shameful amount of time in alehouses over the next several span, lurking quietly, listening to stories. I might even have gone so far as to offer a suggestion or two. I was young, after all, and it was only natural for me to delight in my notoriety. I thought it would fade in time. Why shouldn't I revel a bit in the sidelong glances my fellow students made? Why not enjoy it while it lasted? Many of the stories centered around me hunting bandits and rescuing young girls, but none of them came terribly close to the truth. No story can move 1,000 miles by word of mouth and keep its shape. While the details differed, most of them followed a familiar thread. Young women were in need of rescuing. Sometimes a nobleman hired me. Sometimes it was a concerned father, a distraught mayor, or a bumbling constable. Most of the time, I saved a pair of girls. Sometimes, only one. Sometimes there were 3. They were best friends. They were mother and daughter. I heard one story where there were 7 of them, all sisters, all beautiful princesses, all virgins. You know that sort of story. There was a great deal of variety as to who exactly I was rescuing the girls from. Bandits were fairly common, but there were also wicked uncles, stepmothers, and shamblemen. One story, in an odd twist, had me rescuing them from Adem mercenaries. There was even an ogre or two. While I did occasionally rescue the girls from a troop of traveling players, I'm proud to say I never heard a story where they were kidnapped by the Edema Rue. The story generally had one of two endings. In the first, I leapt to the battle like Prince Gallant and fought sword on sword until everyone was dead, fled, or appropriately repentant. The second ending was more